It's with great pleasure that I introduce our autumn forum. It's called Meltdown, Unemployment, Poverty, and America's Race to the Bottom. That's not a discouraging title. I can't think of a much worse one. I'm going to turn it over to David Newby, who will be sort of our Wisconsin weak person today. And David Newby is known to all of us in his role with the AFL-CIO. The fact that he's here to moderate this evening is great. So, David, I turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Joe. Well, first of all, thank you for being here. We have both an important topic and a huge one, so it's probably a good thing that we have a limit of an hour and a half, and then we'll do this every week for about 20 weeks, and maybe we'll get halfway into it. But I think we're going to have both interesting presentations and, I suspect, a lively discussion both among our panel members, but also including you as well. The format is going to be that each of our panel members will have about 10 minutes for a presentation, and then we will have about 15 minutes of discussion among panel members, among ourselves, and then throw it out to you for about 20 minutes. Following that, the panel will talk about, okay, having had all this discussion, where do we go from here? And we'll try to talk about that for 10 minutes or so, throw it out to you for about 15 to end our program for the evening. Our panelists are Charlie Uphoff, who is the former president of the Fitchburg City Council. To my right is Laura Dresser, who is a labor economist and associate director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. And to my left is Mark Levine, who is professor of history, economic development, and urban studies at UWM, and was the founding director of the Center for Economic Development at UWM. So, Laura, I think we'll start with you to kind of set the stage in terms of employment and wage trends and all that bad news.
Okay, yeah.
We'll go on to Charlie.
Worst news.
who will be focusing especially on questions of inequality, ending up with our final hitter here of Mark Levine, talking about employment, racial polarization, a little bit on inequality, but also about trade, international trade, and deindustrialization. So how he's going to do that in 10 minutes, I haven't the slightest idea. With that, Laura, we'll turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Well, good evening, everyone. It's very nice to see folks who've come out, so thank you, and glad to be part of the ongoing work of the Madison Institute as you try and get more people to be thinking about these hard issues. So, you know, it's a Friday night, and we're at a panel called Meltdown. I feel like that kind of
sort of says it all.
You know, you'll notice that David did indicate we would be moving towards the optimism or the what to do about it. But for the starters, we're going to stick in the grubby pessimism of the current reality. And so I'm just going to do a little bit on that. I think there's a few things that when I think about the American economy and that seem absolutely critical, that are sort of big stage setters that we often leave off sometimes in these conversations, and I often leave out. I talk a lot about the Wisconsin economy, and I would be delighted to be spending time making fun of our governor and pointing out all the ways that Wisconsin is failing working people. But the ways that Wisconsin is failing working people is, you know, kind of extra, the extra marginal worseness here is compared to a national picture that is bad. And I think the national picture is the important one. I want to do a little bit on that, but then I want to back up to a global picture because, you know, in fact, this is, as you know, the richest nation on the planet. And we're as rich as we've ever been. We forget that in a time of austerity politics. You know, so we're as rich as we've ever been, but we're making decisions about which kid to deny medication to, right? But you know, there's the global context as well, and then I'll talk a little bit about global warming as well. But those are, I just thought I should get us more depressed. I thought maybe you hadn't taken on enough bad news, and I just wanted to pull it back for a little extra bad news. But to start with the U.S., the restructuring of the last 30 years, and it really has been consistent, it has delivered more and more gains of economic growth to the top and less and less, especially to the bottom. You all know that. This is not a surprise. Part of the way this has happened is by a complete lack of attention to the bottom of the labor market. And I think this is a place where we've seen really ruinous destruction of standards, basic labor standards, in specific sectors that have rippled out through the economy. So that's one thing I want to call your attention to, is the basement of the labor market, where the floor of this labor market is established. And the easiest thing to talk about is the minimum wage, of course, and its declining value over time because of inflation and the constant fighting we have to do just to move that with inflation. But the other things, yes, the minimum wage, but you all are familiar with that. But also the enforcement of basic labor standards and the ways that we have riddled the bottom of the labor market with new statuses, independent contractors, and other forms of uncovered work. So that workers can't even rely on the protections, either the actual legal protection or the effective legal protection that workers are supposed to rely on. And you may be familiar with day labor corners. This is something that when I was young probably only existed mostly in the South. You could drive to a corner in a southern city and in a truck with a job, you announce your job and you pick four guys who are standing there. This is a kind of African-American corner is the history on that. Day labor is ubiquitous in the United States now, and especially in the big cities. And often you can find gatherings of people at Home Depot offering their services to any truck that comes. Obviously, when a truck picks you up gets to choose who they pick and take you to the work site, the chances that you get paid, the chances that you know the name of your employer or could do anything about redress on that condition are very small. Anyway, so one thing that's happened is that that's a kind of symbol of it, or a kind of you can see the metaphor there and also the reality that's extended a lot of places. But I think we've also extended the kinds of work that functions that way. So we've moved from nursing homes to home health. And in many ways, this is good. Consumers of healthcare services prefer staying in their homes to being in long-term care facilities. Many workers actually prefer the autonomy of that kind of work to long-term care facilities. But in fact, also what we've done is we have made work that used to be formal, where you had an employer, you had a wage standard, you had overtime protection, into often a one-to-one deal between a customer and a care provider. In some cases, you turn that care provider into an independent contractor, or you just make literally into that status of a kind of private business, so no labor protections, or both people believe that worker has that status, whether that's true or not, and the deal is made there. Same thing happens in housekeeping. The deal gets made between two people. The effective reach of labor law doesn't go there. Whether or not the worker is covered by labor law, neither the worker nor the employer thinks they are. And often the worker may be hampered by language and familiarity with this country, doesn't even know what rights they have. So, and also, then there's the threat of immigration, whatever. So we have a large chunk of the population who, because of in addition to restructuring that way, then you add a bunch of immigrant labor with status problems, insufficient papers. You also add a bunch of people into this labor market over time with police records, with conviction records. They also, that's too much paper. So the immigrants have too little paper. The people coming out of the jails have too much paper on their background. But both of them have a very hard time getting into this labor market. And this labor market is riddled with holes that did not exist. And construction is especially the place to see this. If you go out in your neighborhoods and you see your houses in your neighborhood getting fixed, the roofing crew, the painting crew, the drywall crew going inside, almost always heavy immigrant share, violations of OSHA in ways that we did not see in residential 30 years ago, and paid on the day of. A lot of those crews just getting handed a bit of cash at the end of the day. No record of the employment, which, of course, means you can't get unemployment insurance, among other things. Anyway, so there's the bottom of the labor market. I think of that as a big problem. And the restructuring, and I think sometimes, you know, there is a big bunch of action on the top, and later speakers will deal more with how much returns have gone to the top. But I think also we have paid too little attention to the bottom. But then another, you know, when I get depressed and go to a panel called Meltdown on a Friday night, I do think about the fact that this is the richest country on the planet, richest it's ever been, and that if everybody on this planet consumed the way we consume, it would take six planets to provide that level of production, right? So, yes, we have a giant distributional issue in the United States. We make tons and tons of money here, and we deliver it in the most appalling, criminal, disgusting way to the people at the top. We leave out the people at the bottom. We have an enormous disparity. But if you step one step back to the planet, you know, the level of consumption in this nation is not sustainable across this globe. And there's, you know, suffering outside that, kind of think at some point we've got to get to that, you know, and that means something about reducing what we expect out of the economy. I tend to have a language of economic growth, more economic growth is better. Progressives have always done this. We want economic growth so that we can resplit the pie. Yes, we care about distribution, but we also care about growth. But we have to come up with a new language about growth when we are consuming the way we are in the United States. So we have a distribution problem, but we also have just a sheer consumption problem. And the final problem is, of course, the climate, and that's that gets pressed into focus by this consumption issue. And I think that will bring issues to this country that we are increasingly unable to deal with. And what I mean is, climate change is going to be expensive. It's going to put storms on our shores and drought in our center and hit cities, which are all on our shores. And all those cities are going to have to figure out how to hold back the waters and rebuild the bridges and what we're going to do about the Mississippi when it dries up. And there will be a thousand things that will require public works. And we have a state that a consensus on the capacity of the state to do anything is crumbling, and the investment, even in the infrastructure, much of it environmentally inappropriate, that we already have, is moving away. And so that feels also to me like a big challenge. We need the state more in the future, even just for global climate and for redistribution and for anything we care about. We're moving away from that. So that's, I'm sure, my 10 minutes or more, and I'll quit.
Thank you very much.
I gotta love an audience that'll clap for that, man.
All right, Charlie, cheer us up about inequality.
I am given the task of cheering you up. I wish I could do more in that regard. I think there is some hope down the road, but we've got a real problem in this country, and it's nothing new, but it's been getting much, much, much worse in the last few decades. The problem of income inequality goes back way, way before this country. In fact, I came across a quote from Plutarch from like 160 AD. An imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. So the problem has been there for a while. One thing that really struck me and sort of made it very personal, I remember as a young child in Minneapolis, when my dad got a job at the University of Minnesota in 1952, an entry-level position, associate professor at the University of Minnesota, with a starting salary of $7,000. Our house cost $12,000. And I thought, who these days goes into an entry-level position with a starting salary equal to more than half the cost of a house. It's pretty staggering. One of the areas where this growing inequality has been most dramatically reflected is in the difference between compensation for average workers and CEOs. CEO compensation has gone through the roof. I have a chart here somewhere. I can see if I can pull that up for you. I think some of these things are easiest to see graphically if you can take a look. We'll get to that one later. Start a PowerPoint here. Not overwhelm you with this, but this is a, I think you can see it, slide showing the ratio of CEO compensation in the United States compared with other countries around the world. I mean, you hear the mantra that we have to be competitive in a global marketplace, and that's given as a rationale for offshoring jobs, for depressing wages and moving jobs to China and Vietnam. Well, if we're supposed to be competitive, why aren't CEO salaries competitive? That gave me the inspiration for an idea for a great startup company. It's called CEO Outsource. I think, you know, this really has possibilities. You know, it really reflects, I think, some of the disconnect. One of the real problems that we have as a country is that we have had economic policies for a long time that have been based on a lot of mythology. The so-called free market, which is rarely free. The notion that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can get ahead. Well, that hasn't been working for a while. And I think what we need to do is confront, and this relates to the conversation we were having earlier about competitive global marketplace, we're being told that, for example, American auto workers get paid too much. That's the reason we're not competitive. Well, there's a very interesting thing. In Germany, the average wage for auto workers is over $67 an hour. And they built and exported more cars than the United States last year, over 5 million cars, paying their auto workers more than twice as much as American auto workers receive. So these are the kind of things that often don't get much attention, but I think need to be brought out. The other thing I came across, an astonishing source for some headlines. Here's a great one. America Today, 3 million overlords and 300 million serfs. Sounds like, you know, Daily Worker or something. Business Insider. 3 million overlords and 300 million serfs. And this is an article printed in the Daily, printed in the Business Insider. It's really astonishing to see how far things have come. I think part of the good news, if there is some good news here, is I think there's a growing awakening and awareness of how bad things are and the fact that we need to really turn it around. I'm going to see if I can move to another slide here. Wall Street profits up 720% between 2007 and 2009. The unemployment rate up 102%. Home equity, 35% down, negative in numbers. You know, there are some people, I think, who are going to try to tell you that this is just one of those cycles in the market. I'm increasingly inclined to think that really it's not just happenstance. It really has been part of a plan that's been in place for a number of decades right now, which is basically to create and accelerate this ill distribution of income to the point where we are no longer really a democracy. We are an oligarchy at best, or a plutocracy. We have enormous influence on both our economy and our political system by people who have amassed enormous economic wealth and used that wealth to distort the whole political process. And I was really encouraged to see that this was an issue recognized some time ago. In fact, Justice Brandeis said, really nice quote. There's actually a quote from him out in the hallway. We can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, or we can have democracy, but we cannot have both. That's a pretty sobering thought when you think about it in terms of what we're up against. The concentration of income or wealth right now in this country is greater than at any time since the late 1920s, right before the crash. I found some other things that you'll find, that's a little, I think, interesting if you take a look at it. This is one of the most sobering things, is that there's a very high correlation between income inequality and lack of mobility. There's more and more you get concentration of wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people. What it means, that's an impact that lasts over generations. It means that the young people coming along who are at the lower end of the economic scale are not going to have the opportunities or the education or the chances to better themselves. That is a persistent impact that expands decades, spans generations. That's a really sobering and a very serious thought when you think about it, because that really tells us a little bit about what kind of future we can expect for our kids and our grandkids if we don't do something to turn this around. There are a lot of things that are related to how we got here. One of the major impacts or influences has been in politics, with the growing influence of corporations and things like the Citizens United, which has made things dramatically worse in terms of the ability of people, ordinary people, to have a voice. The voice of ordinary people is often drowned out. It's becoming not a matter of one vote, one person, one vote, but $1, one vote. And to give you a very graphic illustration of what that means, you may want to take a look at the chart over on the wall. That really long stack there represents $100 bills over 12 feet high. That is the income per hour last year for David Koch.
Per hour.
A stack of $100 bills over 12 feet high for 1 hour's work last year. That compares with a stack for family, average family practice doctor, of about 7.5 inches for a year. So think about it. David Koch last year made 19 times more per hour than the average family physician made in a year. 62 times more per hour than the average family in this country made in a year. I can't find the words for that. It's obscene. And we really need to find a way of turning that around, because the kind of future that our kids and our grandkids are going to have is not very rosy if we don't find a way to reverse the policies which have given an undue and unearned advantage to the people who are very wealthy, who pay taxes for earned for income based on...
Ah, there it goes.
Well timed.
If only it were so simple.
Signs of the revolution, I guess. But the thing that really struck me is that this is not sustainable. We are at serious risk. Bill Moyer and a number of other people have commented, our democracy is in fundamental peril at this point because of the direction of policies that have gone in the last few years, last few decades. I don't know how to express this and emphasize the importance or the seriousness of dealing with this issue, like I said, because it does really deal not only with what kind of economic opportunities, but what kind of democracy, if we can call it that, we will have going forward. One of the reasons I've sort of gotten really interested in graphs and charts is it's really hard to get your head around a lot of these numbers. I mean, you can talk in terms of millions and billions, and people have no idea what that really looks like, what that means, which is why I was really struck by the illustration with the David Koch's income. When you look at that stack of $100 bills, 12 feet high, for an hour's worth of work, it's really, really amazing. And so one of the things I've been trying to do is to find ways of helping people visualize and get a feel for where we are and where we're headed. There's some great resources in this regard. Mother Jones put together an extended article with a lot of graphs, a couple of which I've included here, which show visually how income is distributed. And there's a really great video that's available online. I don't know if you've seen it. It sort of takes everybody's income and what it would look like, what people think it is, what people think it should be, and what it really is. And the reality is, at the top end, that 1% or the 10th of 1%, it's off the chart. You would need a stepladder in order to be able to reflect that growing disparity in income between people at the very top and people not just at the bottom, people what used to be called the middle. The middle class is an endangered species right now.
And Charlie, with that warning...
we're just about up. We're going to have a lot more time here for some conversation, but hopefully we'll have some time afterwards as well. And if there's any interest in terms of getting copies of some of the graphs and stuff, leave me your email. I'd be happy to send them to you.
Great. Mark, you're on.
Maybe.
Maybe you're not.
I need my slides. It's great to be here. Pleasure to be here from Milwaukee. It's rare for me to be on a panel where everybody's as gloomy as I am about the economy. They refer to me in Milwaukee as Dr. Gloom and Doom when they want to kind of ridicule what I'm talking about. But, you know, I may be the optimist here tonight. I don't know. We'll see. I want to cover kind of three questions really quickly, and they kind of overlap a bit on what Laura and Charlie have already talked about. I want to talk a little bit about employment, a little bit about inequality, and as David said, a bit about trade. On the employment issue, I want to sort of underscore what you all, I think, know, and that is the degree to which the job creation machinery nationally in this state and in the largest city in this state, Milwaukee, is essentially broken, that we are not generating nearly enough jobs for the number of people who are looking for jobs. There is a gap between the number of job seekers and available jobs. The recovery from the Great Recession has been tepid at best. Hand up because I'm not too...
Just a clarification. Is this just the city of Milwaukee?
It is just the city of Milwaukee, and I'll talk about this.
Not the suburbs.
No, just the city. And so on the whole, the job creation machinery isn't functioning. We're not generating enough jobs. The unemployment rate is much too high at this stage of a recovery from a recession. But beneath that generally pessimistic view is the reality that, particularly in the central cities of the United States and particularly for racial minorities in the United States, the employment situation is not just bad, it's horrible. Let me show you what's happened in the largest city in this state, Milwaukee, over the last 40 years. This first slide is a series of maps of census tracts in the city of Milwaukee in which 50% or more, fewer than 50% of males are employed. I've just looked at males to kind of get away from the issue of more women coming into the labor force after the 1970s and the like, just to sort of not confuse the issue. And you can see rather dramatically between 1970 and 2000 the degree to which greater and greater portions of the city essentially became neighborhoods in which a majority of working age males were not in fact working. There were a handful of census tracts in 1970. It really grew between 1980 and 1990 when deindustrialization, the hemorrhaging of manufacturing jobs, took the guts out of the Milwaukee economy, and you see the growth in the north side neighborhoods. By 2000, essentially the entire north side of Milwaukee have 50% or fewer working age males actually employed. This is the current situation, latest data that we have, 2011, and you can see the entire north side of Milwaukee, essentially 50 census tracts, plus a little bit on the northwest side, so it's spreading out a little further, are neighborhoods where, in fact, the majority of people are not working. This is the situation that the celebrated sociologist William Julius Wilson called work disappearing, when work disappears. Well, in fact, in these neighborhoods, work has disappeared. This disappearance of work has a strong racial dimension. If you know anything about Milwaukee, you know the North Side is, in fact, the most segregated, racially segregated area of the city, of the region. It is virtually 100% African American, except for various pockets. And if you look at the unemployment rates, or I should say the employment rates, that is the share of men in, between the ages of 25 and 54, what we call prime working years people employed, you can see the degree to which racial disparities have become yawning in Milwaukee. In the 1970s, 95% of working age white males between the ages of 25 and 54 were employed. 85% of black males between 25 and 54 were employed. Okay, so obviously there is a disparity there. But as you move along, you can see the disparity growing each year so that by 2010, the disparity had reached 33 points, 85%. Note that employment went down for both racial groups, but much more precipitously for black males. And so 85% of white males employed, 52% of black males between the ages of 25 and 54. Now, here's some good news. We're going to be coming out. We're going to be coming out with a paper in a couple of weeks that shows for the first time actually in two decades the black male employment rate has actually gone up slightly in the last year. So it's you see it there as 52%. We're now up to 57%. Still, this, I think, the second worst in the country behind Detroit, but some progress at least in that very modest way. You can see very quickly here, and I'm going to run through this really fast, how Milwaukee stacks up against a sample of other metro areas that we looked at. The red line, as you can probably figure out, is Milwaukee for black male employment rates, again, between the ages of 25 and 54. The blue is Boston. The kind of green is Baltimore. Purple is Minneapolis. And turquoise is St. Louis. You can see that black male employment has dropped everywhere. So the general crisis has been obviously across the country. As Laura says, this is a national issue, although we can obviously talk about things in our state and in our city. But you can see the incredible decline between 1970 and 2010 that I mentioned earlier. Similar decline among white males as well, but not as precipitous, right? So Milwaukee actually is kind of in the middle of the pack, actually slightly toward the top of the pack when you look at all metro areas in terms of white male employment rates. So the rate has gone down, but Milwaukee is actually better compared to other metro areas. Well, what's happened as a consequence of that broken job creation machinery is that Milwaukee is one of the capitals of poverty in the country. Again, not particularly widely known, increasingly known around here, but again, you can see in the same pattern that I showed with regard to the employment changes, a few census tracts in the city in 1970, in which 40% or more of the population lived under the poverty line. By 1980, it had gone up. 1990, again, that entire north side. 2000 begins to spread a little bit, actually, to the northwest side. And here you can see 2011. The overall poverty rate in the city of Milwaukee today is 30%, 29.9%. The black poverty rate is 42%. But again, those horrible statistics actually aren't the worst aspect of the situation. It's this concentration of poverty where issues of mobility, issues of concentrated cumulative disadvantage, as Robert Sampson talks about it, are present. So you can see, you know, this consequence of the breakdown of the job creation machinery. All right, so the first point is broken job creation, racial disparities. The second point I want to make is that And this relates very much to what Charlie was talking about. I'll go through this very quickly, is that our economy is suffering through the end of the era of shared prosperity. There has been a divergence. The fortunes of the top slice of the economy and those, obviously, at the bottom that Laura described so eloquently. And there are a number of ways to look at this. Charlie talked about some inequality measures. But one way to look at it is the share of national income that goes to corporate profits versus workers' earnings. Historically, those have gone more or less in tandem, but historically, workers' income has been around 68 to 70% of national income. Today, it's down to 62%. It's the lowest level since 1950. Corporate profits at 14% of national income are the highest they've been, again, since the 1950s. So we've had an incredible kind of redistribution at the level of income. And I think The point that needs to be made is the one that Doug Fraser made in 1978 when he quit the Labor Management Cooperation Commission that President Carter had put together. It's the point that Warren Buffett made when he talked about the politics of inequality in America, when they both said, essentially, I'll quote Buffett, there's a class war going on in this country, but it's my class against the rest of the population. And you can see this in basically the share of income going to corporate profits as opposed to worker income. Another dimension of this, and again, the degree to which our shared prosperity has essentially come apart, is the degree to which the historical relationship between productivity increases by business and workers' income have essentially separated. The Economic Policy Institute, from whom I've stolen this graph, has studied this and calls this the wedge now that it's developed between productivity and wages. And you can see through the 1970s, productivity and worker compensation move in tandem from the 1940s, from the late 1940s until the mid-1970s, or the early 1970s, they move together so that when companies improve their productivity and hence improve their profits as a consequence of some complicated historical factors that I'm happy to talk about, the so-called Treaty of Detroit being the main factor, those processes moved in tandem. Corporations did better. Workers did better. A fair share, more or less, was passed along to workers. That changed after the 1970s. My argument would be largely it changed as a consequence of the war against workers that was launched by corporate mobilization that has transmogrified since then into many, many worse ways. And so, consequently, since the 1970s, you can see that gap widening. It's widened even further and precipitously since 2000. Since 2000, for example, productivity has gone up 25%. Hourly compensation, real hourly compensation, adjusted for inflation, has gone up zero. So basically all of the gains have essentially gone to businesses. And we see that, you know, with the inequality measures that have just come out, for example. The top 1% since the recovery have gotten about 95% of all the income gains. I know I'm throwing a lot of statistics out, but you can just see they all point in the same direction. Workers losing out, more going to those at the top. Charlie already mentioned skyrocketing CEO pay. There's another indicator of that. And again, hot off the presses, this is another paper we'll be bringing out in a few weeks, but I thought you might like, and, you know, maybe I doubt any of these people would watch the tape, but if they did, it'd be fun to tweak them. These are some well-known Wisconsin companies, and what we're doing is looking at the growth of CEO pay in these companies since the 1990s. And you can see that some modest increases have occurred. The CEO, for example, of A. O. Smith earned in inflation-adjusted dollars about $1.2 million in 1992. Last year, he took home just under $7 million. That's a 438% increase in pay. The CEO of Johnson Controls, Jim Keyes, in 1992, made $2.1 million. In 2012, Steve Rohl took home a modest $21.4 million. Okay, it's not John Paulson billion-dollar hedge fund money, but it's a nice little piece of change. That's only an 876% increase. You can go down the list here, and you can see the one I particularly love is Wisconsin Energy, where Gale Klappa, the CEO, took home $13 million last year from essentially a public utility. CEO, Rich Abdu, in 1992 made $825,000. That's a 1,483% pay increase. The average worker in Wisconsin took home an 11% increase during this period. Final point, I got a minute, trade. We're losing jobs, a substantial number to trade and to offshoring. This chart shows where the jobs have been created, or I should say where multinational companies have either added or subtracted jobs over the last decade. The blue kind of curve at the top are jobs overseas. The turquoise below are jobs lost at home. About 3 million jobs have been subtracted from those multinationals. About 2.7 million have been created in their branches, or I should say, overseas. Basically, to borrow again a line from an article that I thought it called great attention to this by Krista Freeland, basically what multinational corporations are saying with their offshoring and the like is our CEOs are telling us they don't need us anymore. The CEO of Allstate was quoted in the article as basically saying, American workers need to understand we can get workers anywhere in the world. And that may be a problem for American workers, but it isn't a problem for American business. And that kind of brings us back to the issue of the lack of shared prosperity anymore. Okay, lots of other issues. I'm sure we'll have a lot of time to discuss them. Thank you.
Thanks.